Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. As I said at the top of the broadcast, the main element in the December surprise and the main focus of tonight's broadcast is the connection between a Syrian-born arms and drug trafficking individual, a fellow named Manzur al-Kassar, who in addition to being a major drug trafficker, uses the proceeds from his drug trafficking operation to help support terrorist activities around the world. He is connected to, among others, Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas, Abu Nidal being one of the names initially kicked around in the bombing of Pan Am 103. As we will see, there are allegations that Abu Nidal, among others, were hooked up with a group of international terrorists whose activities involved the players who were involved in Pan Am 103. We will look at the inter-terror group, as the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report terms it, later in the broadcast. However, we're going to begin this evening by reviewing a section from Radio Free America number 32, the fourth broadcast in a seven-part and ongoing Radio Free America archive series dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal. What we're going to be doing here is reviewing information from September of 1987, outlining not only the facts of, but the significance of, the connection between Manzur al-Kassar and Oliver North, the White House National Security Council, National Security Aide, who was overseeing many of the machinations in the Iran-Contra scandal. And it is Oliver North's connection to Manzur al-Kassar, as I said, that we'll be looking at this evening. The main things to focus on this evening are Manzur al-Kassar's connections to, among others, Abu Abbas and Abu Nidal, his connection, of course, to Oliver North, very shocking in that Oliver North is supposed to be vehemently opposed to and violently opposed to people like Manzur al-Kassar, not only for his terrorist activities, but his drug-dealing activities as well. Take a look also at the organization Merex. Now, Merex is the firm implicated in the Iria deal. Merex is a company, an arms trafficking firm, originally begun by a protege of former Nazi SS man Otto Skorzeny, a fellow who jumped to the CIA with the Galen organization, the Nazi spy outfit that we have spoken about so long on this program, that was brought into the CIA at the end of World War II, and which tragically left a very strong imprint on the United States, and in particular its espionage apparatus. As a result, the Galen organization has had a profound effect on our history, and the final incarnation of the Galen organization, the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, is an organization which has used Merex in the past, and in particular has used Merex for a variety of activities, including smuggling arms to Italian terrorists associated with the Propaganda Douay Lodge, which in turn is going to be figuring in the discussion in the next couple of weeks. The P2 Lodge ties into the Iran-Contra scandal in a number of different ways, specifically, very briefly, the Valsella Mecanotechnica case, which is discussed in Radio Free America 32, the Stebaum case, which is discussed in Radio Free America program number 21, and again in supplements to 32 and 34, and the Shikarki AG case, which is contained in supplements to Radio Free America 34. I realize these are strange names, and they don't mean a whole lot to the average listener. That's not to be patronizing or condescending, but because these complications are not only so complicated, but take such a long time to review, the archive shows are the best that I can recommend for someone that finds this discussion impenetrable. Again, Radio Free America, it's 21, 32, and 34, important in this regard. We're going to be taking a look at Merex. We're going to be taking a look also at a fellow named Arif Durrani, last name D-U-R-R-A-N-I, a Pakistani-born arms trafficker, an individual whose name is going to be front and center in the broadcast next week. This individual also had a company called Merex, which, whether it was the same Merex, as I suspect, or a branch of the same Merex, or a different Merex, is anybody's guess. But certainly, there are strong connections between the Italian terrorist and P2 milieu that was involved with Merex and the same milieu that was involved with Arif Durrani, an individual involved with a Merex, perhaps the same Merex. We will be going into these admittedly strange-sounding connections next week at greater length, but note again, Manzur al-Kassar, his association with Oliver North, his connection to the Iria deal, which in my opinion was one of the main factors in obliging the dismissal of conspiracy charges against Oliver North, because the special prosecutor was seeking documents concerning the Iria deal, Manzur al-Kassar involved with the Iria deal, and therefore when Abu Nidal A Manzer Al-Qasar associate was mentioned in connection with the bombing of Pan Am 103. Everything connected to the Nidal milieu had to be kept classified, for it was central to the investigation. We're going to be taking a look also at Merex. Note Merex and store away for next week not only Merex, a very important corporation, but store away Arif Durrani as well. The P2 Lodge is something that we have looked at many times in the past. We have looked at it, as I said, primarily in Radio Free America shows 17 through 21. We also came back to it in Radio Free America 25, 32, 34, 35 to a certain extent. And we will be touching on the P2 in the addendum to the December surprise that we're doing this week as well as next week. So those of you who are in a position to start taping, please do so now. We're going to play a section of Radio Free America 32, and this will cover points that are central not only to tonight's discussion, but next week's as well. In addition to my voice, you will hear the voice of my charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with reading duties and also served as, I guess you could say, sort of color man or designated schmoozer. Certainly, he presented the velvet glove to my iron fist. In any event, this is a broadcast from September of 1987. Those of you who are in a position to do so, get ready to tape. 3, 2, 1, here we go. But there are numerous and very disturbing connections between elements of the American National Security Establishment, in particular, people grouped around Oliver North and the Iran-Contra team, and many of the most heinous terrorist groups, including some of the terrorist groups this team was most active against, at least if we are to believe the cover story. A good example of that last scenario was carried in the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, April 20th of 1987. This is a story by Miguel Acoca. I'm not sure how his name is pronounced. A-C-O-C-A of the Examiner Washington Bureau. It's Dateline Washington headlined, North Link to Top Syrian Arms Dealer. A billionaire Syrian weapons dealer and drug trafficker linked to the hijacking of the Aquile Loro was paid for arms he sold to the Nicaraguan rebels from a bank account controlled by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, sources here and in Europe said. The weapons merchant, who operates from a palatial mansion in Spain's Costa del Sol, is Mansur Al-Qasar, last name Al-Kassar, 40, member of a prominent Syrian family, a broker for the Polish and North Korean state-owned arms industries, and a weapons supplier to Palestinian extremists in Western Europe and the Middle East, sources said. He made at least three major weapons shipments of Polish AK-47s, ammunition, rocket launchers, and SAM-7 anti-aircraft missiles to the U.S.-backed Contra rebels in 1984 and 85, the sources said. North's Contra supply network continued to buy from Al-Qasar with money from a Swiss bank account, despite official British warnings to the United States about Al-Qasar's background, the London Observer has reported. North is the former National Security Council aide who was fired last November for his involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. The New York Newsday newspaper, reporting Monday on the Al-Qasar-North connection, said it was unclear how North's private arms network approached Al-Qasar. Excuse me. And turning to the inside part of the article. Let's see. The New York Newsday newspaper, reporting Monday on the Al-Qasar-North connection, said it was unclear how North's private arms network approached Al-Qasar for the weaponry or whether the buyers knew of his background. But one recently retired intelligence official told the newspaper, quote, "The first time I ever threw his, Al-Qasar's name out, not knowing who he was, every alarm bell in Christendom rang. Then we quickly stepped back because we found out we had a cobra by the tail," unquote. The former intelligence officer said Al-Qasar's family, including several brothers, is, quote, "reputed to be the largest drug and arms-dealing family in Syria," unquote. He said Al-Qasar buys arms wholesale for the Palestine Liberation Organization, which then retails them for profit. Newsday said a U.S. criminal record document dealing with Al-Qasar bears the label terrorist at the top of the page and claims he, quote, has alleged ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is controlled by Dr. George Habash. The weapons shipped by Al-Qasar were shipped to Central America through the Portuguese firm Defex Portugal, the sources said. At least one weapons load went by air from Warsaw to Lisbon aboard a state-owned Polish airliner, one source said. Al-Qasar also bought weapons for the Contras through a British firm and sold weapons to Iran, sources said. The certificates necessary to ship the weapons from Portugal were provided by Honduran and Guatemalan military officers with close ties to the CIA and the Pentagon. Defex Portugal was associated with Energy Resources International,
a Panamanian corporation that made at least 19 shipments from Lisbon to the Contras between 1984 and 6, according to Portuguese intelligence sources. Energy Resources was controlled by former CIA and military officers working for North. The former officers ran the Contra operation during the 1984-86 congressional ban on direct or indirect American military supplies for the rebels. Energy Resources is owned by Stanford Technology Corporation, a California firm controlled by Albert Hakim of Los Gatos. We'll be coming back to that later. Hakim is a business associate of retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord. North also was a leading player in the Reagan administration's counterterrorism operations and in secret weapon sales to Iran. His activities in the Iran-Contra scandal are the object of investigations by two congressional committees and independent counsel Lawrence Walsh. Public congressional hearings on the scandal are scheduled to open May 5th. The irony in Alcazar's involvement with the Contras is his link to Mohammed Abbas, A-B-B-A-S, the terrorist leader who allegedly masterminded the hijacking of the Achille Lauro cruise ship. North was widely applauded in 1985 for organizing the mid-air interception of the airliner carrying Abbas following the hijacking of the ship in Egypt. Abbas, who was wanted in the United States for the murder of U.S. hostage Leon Klinghoffer on the Italian ship, was subsequently released by Italian authorities. Alcazar also has been linked to Abu Nidal, another terrorist wanted by U.S. authorities, sources said. Abu Nidal's real name is Sabri Albana. Several things to take note of here. First of all, the link of a major player in the Oliver North Contra supply effort of someone connected not only to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine by George Habash, one of the top Palestinian terrorist groups, but also, perhaps more importantly for our purposes, to Abdul Abbas, rather, the fellow behind the Achille Lauro hijacking, and Abu Nidal, one of the prime movers on the international terrorist scene today, is intriguing. And again, it's worth noting that Oliver North himself has gained much political mileage from his alleged opposition to these very same groups. Also take note of the fact that this particular operation here was carried out by a company owned by Stanford Technology Corporation here in the Silicon Valley. We're going to come back to Stanford Technology, its links, namely International Imaging Systems, with another company called TCI, and some other things here in just a second. But again, we're thinking about the connections between Oliver North, the All-American Patriot, and the very forces he would have us believe he's working against. The question that we're asking is, does this association of others like it indicate, in fact, that if he's not an actual ally of these people, that he is willing to use them consciously in order to generate some of the effects that we have hinted at?
This bit of information linking Oliver North and his organization with folks linked to Abu Nidal also put something, before I read the next article, I wanted to throw something in that I had noted before and didn't really have a context for it, but this seems like an interesting context, of a rather curious lie that Oliver North told during the course of the questioning going on most recently. This was in the earlier Alexander Coburn column or article that we read from In These Times, and it's just a short paragraph here, but it is rather strange, and put in the light of some of the things we've just been talking about, it may make more sense. Coburn writes, "A telling example of North's lying was his fervent tribute to the, quote, brave Major Steiner, who arrested the Achille Lauro hijackers as they stepped onto Italian soil from the plane forced down by U.S. fighters and handed them over to the Italian authorities." Now, that's what Oliver North claimed happened. This bears no resemblance to what actually happened. As news accounts made clear at the time, U.S. and Italian security personnel were present when the skyjacked plane landed. The Italian Carabinieri, which is the Italian police, got to the plane first and took charge of the Achille Lauro hijackers. The U.S. force on the tarmac, presumably commanded by the redoubtable Major Steiner, demanded that the Italians hand over the hijackers, hoping to fly them to the U.S. But after what was described at the time as a gunpoint confrontation, Steiner and his men backed down, and the Italians took the hijackers away. Rather interesting in light of Oliver North's own involvement with the, or at least connections to the Achille Lauro case, that he should tell such a blatant lie about the circumstances having to do with the capture of Abu Abbas and the fact that American forces should be trying to take these prisoners from the Italians on Italian soil at gunpoint. It does raise some interesting questions. Now we're going to go on and read an article published in the San Francisco Chronicle for Friday, July 17th, 1987, that goes into this in a little more detail. The article is headlined, "North's Network Dealt with Man Tied to Abu Nidal." The article is by Michael Wines of the Los Angeles Times, and it's datelined Washington. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's secret arms network supplied Nicaraguan rebels with $1.5 million in weapons bought in 1985 and 1986 from a Syrian smuggler tied to terrorist Abu Nidal, according to records released by the Congressional Iran-Contra Panel. The weapons, apparently of Polish origin, were purchased from Mansour al-Kassar, a Damascus drug smuggler and arms merchant. The 42-year-old Kassar and his three brothers have built a multi-million-dollar empire on military deals in communist and Western Europe. Administration officials, speaking on condition that they not be named, said that Kassar has clearly established business links to the Abu Nidal terrorist ring, responsible for a November 1985 Egypt Air hijacking in which 57 persons died, and for December 1985 massacres in the Rome and Vienna airports. The congressional records point up a particular irony for North, who dramatically invoked a death threat by Abu Nidal in testimony last week to explain his acceptance of a $16,000 security system financed with cash from North's network. Lebanese terrorists claiming to represent Abu Nidal placed North's name on an assassination list last year, apparently because of his work on U.S. counterterrorism policies. So again, pointing up the fact of the Abu Nidal network somehow, strangely, in the person of Mansour al-Kassar and his brethren, he and his brethren's empire, being connected to Oliver North's putative anti-terrorist organization. But as we have seen so much in the past, especially with his secret team, Ed Wilson, Frank Turple et al., Richard Secord, the whole group of them, Shackley and Kleins, have spent 35 years or so, most of them, doing just this, taking so-called terrorist organizations, infiltrating them, taking them over or directing them and using them as excuses for, as Dave put it, the dissolution of American civil liberties at home and the expansion of U.S. military presence abroad. That being the case, we should look at Oliver North's contacts with Abu Nidal, perhaps in the light of being a little more than just a sort of another ironic detail in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yeah, again, I think people might want to think about Oliver North, the kind of person he represents in a symbolic sense, and ask one how someone like that could possibly have dealt with people like this if he is to be taken at face value, and obviously we feel that perhaps he is not. And again, the Rex 84 scenario should be brought to mind here. More information concerning this particular deal, the Mansour al-Kassar deal, emerged in the San Jose Mercury News of Monday, April 20th of 1987. This is a story headlined, Terror Suspect Dealt in Contra Arms. This is from an article alluded to in the Examiner article I read a few minutes ago. This is by Newt Royce of Newsday, K-N-U-T-R-O-Y-C-E. Again, headline, Terror Suspect Dealt in Contra Arms, subheaded North's Aid Network Handled Purchase. Skipping down in the article, we find the following. Some of this will be by way of review. Al-Kassar's 158 tons of arms for the Contras, including AK-47 assault rifles and ammunition, were put aboard a Panamanian freighter, the Aria, E-R-R-I-A, which then steamed out of the Polish port of Szczecin on July 10th. Published accounts, which have not disclosed Al-Kassar's role in the arms transaction, have said that the Aria was purchased on April 28th by Hakim through a Panamanian shell company, Dolmy Business Incorporated. Dolmy is D-O-L-M-Y. The arms were purchased by another Panamanian corporation, Energy Resources International, which is owned by the Stanford Technology Corporation, a California firm controlled by Hakim. Secord is Hakim's associate in the Stanford Technology Trading Group in the Virginia suburbs of Washington. Secord's attorney Thomas C. Green did not return calls to his office, nor did Hakim's attorney N. Richard Janis. North's attorney Brendan Sullivan could not be reached for comment. Al-Kassar could not be reached at his Vienna, Austria firm, Alcastronic, and there are no telephone listings for his residences in Vienna or the resort town of Marbella, Spain, where he is said to spend most of his time. I would take note of the Kassar presence in Vienna. That may or may not be significant. We'll comment on it later. Sources said Al-Kassar acted as a middleman in the deal. They said he purchased the arms from Cenzin, C-E-N-Z-I-N, the Polish agency that controls foreign trade, and then sold them to North's group. Details on the buying and selling prices and the financing arrangements could not be learned. Skipping down in the article of the Odyssey of the Aria with all of these Al-Kassar-purchased weapons, the author writes, So the 358 tons of arms remained aboard the Aria, which lingered off Portugal for nearly 2 months. In early September, however, the ship traveled to the French port of Cherbourg and unloaded the entire cargo on the port's munition dock September 13th. A second ship, the Iceland Saga, picked up the arms and on September 20th set sail for Puerto Barrios, Guatemala. Two sources said they think that at this time, the CIA agreed to buy the arms through an American arms dealer, James P. Atwood, A-T-W-O-O-D, for $1.4 million. One source said that the arms had a retail value of $5.5 million and that Hakim and Secord had been trying to get more than $2 million for the shipment. There are a number of things in this story that we're going to take up at some length and we're going to look at against the background of the Achille Lauro hijacking. However, the name James P. Atwood is very significant for our purposes here. He is not only an arms dealer who's reportedly done a lot of work for the U.S. intelligence community in the past, he is an associate not only of Frank Tribbles, but also of an arms for drug smuggling ring we looked at in Radio Free America number 26. Sometimes I forget the name. It was number 26, called The Company, quote-unquote. Now, that's not The Company, quote-unquote, namely the insider's nickname for the CIA, but rather it's called The Company, quote-unquote, although it appears that The Company may, in fact, work with The Company, and James P. Atwood is one of the reasons why, and if that sounds confusing, we're now going to try and straighten out that confusion.
We're going to do our best. It is very confusing, and again, we're talking about, in the next article we're going to read, when they refer to The Company, the reference is to, in fact, the supposedly private organization known as The Company, a guns and drugs smuggling operation that has cropped up in a variety of cases, most recently including the murder of Judge John Woods down in Texas, the only federal judge ever to be assassinated. He was sitting in on a very important drugs case, and the man who was convicted of killing him claimed to have been one of the gunmen in the JFK assassination, with some rather interesting backup for his story. So The Company crops up in a lot of rather interesting places.
Again, for background on this, for people who would like to explore this further, Radio Free America number 26, our archive show on file, goes into The Company at some length. And incidentally, we will be coming back to The Company in a big way in our program about the cover-up, because President Reagan's recent nominee to head up the FBI, Judge William Sessions, was the fellow who presided over the trial of Charles Harrelson, for the assassination of Judge John Wood. So we're going to come back to that. The Company, the Wood assassination, very significant for our purposes here.
That's right. But in the upcoming article, again, as mentioned, The Company here refers to the supposedly private organization, not the nickname for the CIA. But as you will see, as so many often happens in these cases, the gray area is very large, and where one company ends and the other begins is a matter for debate. Anyway, what we're going to read for here is an unpublished manuscript by Jonathan Marshall that was, I guess it's the original draft for Parapolitics number 1. Parapolitics, a newsletter put together by Jonathan Marshall with the help of some other folks. Jonathan Marshall is currently editorial page editor for the Oakland Tribune. And again, we've used his work. He's also worked a great deal with Ted Rubenstein, who we have had a lot of help from and gotten a lot of good research work from. Anyway, reading from a draft for Parapolitics number 1. One of the key figures in The Company was John Etheridge, Etheridge. John Etheridge, who surrendered last fall and is now cooperating with the authorities. He was a former aide to Congressman John Jenrette Jr., who was defeated for re-election following his conviction in the Abscam case. According to a source familiar with the case, Etheridge was also the go-between for Frank Turple and Colonel James Atwood, an international gun dealer who sold large caches of arms abroad, particularly to Latin America. Should just insert, again, Atwood was the man mentioned in the last story that Dave read as being the supplier for some of the Contra arms supplies. Atwood had a history of service for U.S. intelligence agencies and is widely rumored to have done favors for the CIA, although he denies it. In 1978, he leased an island estate in a salt creek near Savannah, Georgia, to Bradley Bryant, kingpin of the Philadelphia branch of The Company. Some unconfirmed sources claim that the estate doubled as some kind of mercenary training center. Bryant and Atwood fell out later in the year, and Atwood booted his associate out. So again, the connection here between John Etheridge, Etheridge, a man who, among other things, worked for not only The Company itself, but also for John Jenrette. Jenrette, of course, remembered from the Abscam case, and his lovely wife, Rita Jenrette, who, among other things, helped to drive the fugitive Frank Turple to the airport so he could flee the country. And he has never come back, at least not publicly. Again, the link between Etheridge being the go-between between Turple and the aforementioned Colonel James Atwood, international gun dealer, and also apparently a part of Oliver North's little network.
And again, Jeb Bradley Bryant of The Company also retained the services of James Atwood for a relatively short period. Harkening back to a couple of the connections of The Company that we talked about in Radio Free America 26, before we go on with some more information about The Company, one of the things that we brought to mind was not only that Charles Harrelson, the fellow eventually convicted of assassinating Judge John Wood, he claimed a couple of interesting things. He claimed that the Drug Enforcement Administration had Judge Wood killed in order to cover up their own role as conspirators in the narcotics traffic. in Radio Free America number 29, as well as our four-part series, or was it 24, 5, 6, 7, 8, five-part series on the intelligence services' role in the narcotics traffic, revealed that, in fact, such a claim is far from fantastic. Also, Harrelson claimed that he was one of the trigger men in the assassination of John Kennedy, and in an interesting article by Gary Mack, an assassination researcher, we saw connecting links between Charles Harrelson and a number of Dallas-area organized crime figures involving, among others, Jack Ruby, and intersecting with the organized crime network of Santos Traficante. Santos Traficante investigated by the House Select Committee on Assassinations following his boast, or because of his boast that Kennedy would be assassinated long before Kennedy was, and he gave the scenario. Worth noting, because Santos Traficante, as we looked at in RFA number 29, was a key member of what the Christic Institute termed the shooter's team, and many members of the secret team go back to Station JM Wave, headed by Theodore Shackley, the campaign on the Bay of Pigs, and the Santos Traficante shooter's team. That's why we bring it up here, and we'll be coming back to it in the cover-up section.
Just wanted to mention real quickly that Charles Harrelson's allegations about the DEA and about his suggestion that the DEA had bumped off Judge Woods to cover up their own involvement in the drug traffic did not come after. It came sometime before the breaking of the Iran-Contra story, which, of course, brought a lot of this stuff out in the public eye and made it a lot more politically possible to come forward and say, yeah, we were working for the Drug Enforcement Agency, or we were working for the CIA when we were illegally smuggling drugs, as many currently indicted drug dealers have said, most of them probably with great truthfulness. However, Harrelson's case was actually up, what, in
1979 or 80.
79, 80, yeah. And long before any of this stuff had come out, and at the time, of course, as usually happens, is regarded as the purest sort of fantasy by most people. But again, as we have one step beyond, and Mae Russell listeners have known for a long time, and as most of the public is now getting a chance to sort of know since the Iran-Contra thing broke, these kinds of things are going on all the time, and Charles Harrelson's words begin to seem more and more truthful as time goes by.
Now, of the apparent connections, obviously, one of the things that we've talked about in connection with the company is that it appears that if it's not actually part of the CIA or one of our other intelligence services, that they certainly work with those same intelligence services. Just such a connection is maintained in the following article I'm going to read. It's called The Company They Keep. It's by Joe Pennington, P-E-N-N-I-N-G-T-O-N, and Stanley Pinsley, P-I-N-S-L-E-Y. This is a superb article published in a now-defunct publication called The Soho News, from The Soho News of November 24th, 1981. Soho News was an alternative newspaper in New York City, and it went out of publication very shortly after this article was published. In fact, I think this may have been the last issue. When you hear about some of the information, it suggests at least one reason why that may have happened. Research credit on this, by the way, also goes to Mae Russell. I'm going to do the best I can reading the article. It's not the best Xerox copy. There have been several Xeroxes done off of the original. The printing is a little bit spotty in places, so if I'm a little hesitant, please bear with me. I'll reread anything that I botch here, but it's a little bit difficult to read this copy. Again, The Company They Keep, Joe Pennington, Stanley Pinsley, Soho News, 11/24/81. Over the past 3 years, traditional hostilities between the Justice Department and the Central Intelligence Agency, which date back to J. Edgar Hoover's feud with the CIA's precursor, the Office of Strategic Services, have escalated into an all-out struggle over domestic and international covert operations. According to sources in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, late in August of 1978, during the controversial Church Committee inquiry into CIA activities, the Justice Department maintained a full-scale investigation of an organized crime syndicate active in drug smuggling and gun running. In the course of its investigation, codenamed Operation Gateway, the FBI developed leads which pointed to links between the syndicate and persons and institutions associated with the CIA. The 14-state investigation, based in Washington, D.C. and East St. Louis, coordinated the activities of six federal agencies, the FBI, Drug Enforcement Administration, Internal Revenue Service, Federal Aviation Administration, U.S. Customs, and the Treasury Department, and is currently active in Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Michigan. The information developed by Gateway has created considerable concern within the intelligence community, pointing as it does to an essentially white-collar criminal underworld that has tangential and possibly substantial connections to men who are allegedly former CIA agents, to professed covert CIA operatives and DEA agents. According to John K. Russell, a spokesman for the Justice Department, Operation Gateway was an undercover operation which resulted in the arrest and convictions of members of the company, a huge drug and arms smuggling conspiracy with ties to elements in the intelligence community. Operation Gateway, in fact, has... part of this is botched. Oh, wait a minute. Here we go. Operation Gateway, in fact, has made its special province a specific set of criminal operations which involve the movement of arms and secret electronic components to foreign governments.
This particular article was sent in by a listener. It's from the Toronto Star of November 13th of 1989. This article, as I said, sums up the Pan Am 103 insurance investigators report and will lead directly into the rebroadcast of five or so pages that I read into the record about 5 years ago. This is from the Toronto Star of November 13th, 1989. It's by John Picton, P-I-C-T-O-N, of the Toronto Star. It's dateline Washington, D.C., and it's headlined, Pan Am Bomb Linked to Double-Dealing CIA Drug Plot. An eight-man team of CIA agents was aboard Pan Am Flight 103 last December 21st after completing a hostage mission in Beirut, the Sunday Star has learned. According to a Pan Am report, the team had photographed a secret location in Lebanon where U.S. hostages were being held. The report, shown exclusively to the Star, was commissioned by Pan Am after Flight 103 blew up over Lockerbie, killing 269 people, two of them Canadian. The agents became outraged when they discovered another branch of the CIA was involved in an illegal drugs and arms operation to get the hostages released. The Beirut team was returning home without permission, quote, which is against the rules, unquote, to publicize the CIA drugs operation. Quoting, they, the team, had communicated back to Langley, CIA's Virginia headquarters, the facts and names and reported their film of the hostage locations. CIA did nothing. No reply. Again quoting, and this is quoting from the report, the team was outraged, believing that the rescue and their lives would be endangered by the double dealing. One of the leaders of the group was Major Charles McKee of the U.S. Army, assigned temporarily to the CIA. The Sunday Star has been told he phoned his mother last December to say he would be home for Christmas. After his death, agents with the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation visited McKee's mother to ask her if her son had left any packages with her. They also said that some of the belongings in his luggage could not be returned and would be destroyed in the national interest. One man figures prominently in the report, 42-year-old Manzer El-Kassar, a well-connected Syrian who was married to the sister of Syria's intelligence chief and is said to have had a long-term romantic relationship with the niece of Syrian President Hafez Assad. Al-Kassar holds two Brazilian passports, as well as a Syrian diplomatic passport, and has a luxury apartment on Avenue Foch in Paris for some of his romantic liaisons. He is said to share offices with terrorist Abu Nidal in Libya, one at 2 Stawkis, S-T-A-W-K-I-S Street in Warsaw, Poland, and another on Friedrichstrasse in East Berlin under the cover name Zibado, Z-I-B-A-D-O. Al-Kassar entered the picture when the West German intelligence agency BKA was tipped off about a drug smuggling operation centered on Frankfurt Airport where Pan Am's Flight 103 originated. There, ordinary suitcases were checked in the normal way and passed through to the baggage section. Turkish baggage handlers recruited at mosques in West Germany knew which bags to watch for and substituted them for identical luggage containing drugs and other contraband. The passenger later picked up the new bag at his destination. BKA shared this intelligence with the CIA. Says the report, quote, it is not known how this method passed through the arrival customs, but this route and method worked steadily and smoothly for a long time. BKA shared this intelligence with the CIA, which had been aware for some time that the East Bloc was using Frankfurt Airport as a shipping point for unspecified goods, quote-unquote, to Moscow. The West Germans even closed down other drug operations with a series of raids and stepped up police presence to channel more shipments through Pan Am where they could be observed more easily. The report suggests the CIA unit involved, which it calls CIA 1, was not part of the regular agency since it, quote, has a control at an unknown location in the Washington area. That last paragraph again. The report suggests the CIA unit involved, which it calls CIA 1, was not part of the regular agency since it has a, quote, control at an unknown location in the Washington area, unquote. Then, after a successful French arms for hostages deal, quote, CIA 1, the CIA unit investigated, then identified Al-Kassar as a major player in the drug routes and identified his background and blood ties to Syria's intelligence chief, the report says. So CIA 1 decided to try for the same deal as the French to get back the American hostages, unquote. Then, in one of a string of bombshells, the report states, quote, and this is a very important section here, BKA/CIA1, approached Alcazar and offered to allow him to continue his drug smuggling routes, and especially into the U.S., if he helped arrange release of the American hostages via his well-placed contacts. Then, quote, "However, Alcazar helped CIA-1 in sending weapons ostensibly to Iran through his buying connection, supposedly to further the U.S. hostage release. He also helped in another CIA-1 enterprise," unquote. And another bombshell, again quoting, "He offered or agreed to use his other arms routes to purchase and transship arms to the Nicaraguan Contras," unquote, "even helping to finance some of the shipments," unquote. Alcazar was under surveillance now and was seen meeting a man at the restaurant Ajami, A-G-A-M-I, on Rue Lincoln in Paris. The man he met was identified as Ahmed Jibril, head of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command. Jibril was under pressure from several sources to engineer a terrorist strike against the United States. The sources, as outlined in the report, the Iranian government, which wanted revenge for the shooting down of one of its airliners for the Persian Gulf by the USS Vincennes, Hezbollah, a fundamentalist Islamic organization, and Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, who for years has been financing terrorist acts. But they wanted a strike arranged in such a way as to give them cover or deniability, quote-unquote. Jibril was the man selected by the various Islamic factions to make the strike. He had discovered Alcazar's safe conduct operation through Frankfurt and had decided to use it to plant a bomb. As his accomplice, he selected a Turkish courier named Khalid Jafar, J-A-F-A-R, who had no record as a terrorist. Both men met a Libyan bomb maker known as the Professor, quote-unquote, in Bonn, West Germany, on December 13th of 1988. They were joined by a Syrian explosives expert traveling under the cover name of Patel, P-A-T-E-L, who shortly after left for Lisbon. A man identified as Ali Rasep, a Syrian living in Sofia, Bulgaria, is said to have gathered the bomb components, which included a barometric timer able to withstand the pressure of two takeoffs, since Flight 103 was to land in London en route to New York. Alcazar provided the route by which the bomb was smuggled into West Germany after the terrorists' own bomb-making center at Neuss, N-E-U-S-S, had been raided by the BKA the previous month. Alcazar's sister-in-law, traveling on a South Yemen diplomatic passport, flew from Damascus, Syria, to Sofia last November 13th, picked up the bomb components from Rasep, and flew with them to Paris. Alcazar picked them up, rented a car from a firm called Shafiq on November 25th, and took them to Frankfurt. And he felt confident crossing the border since he had been arrested by West German border guards twice before, but had been released each time after a phone call. Originally, says the report, Jibril had targeted American Airlines for the bombing. But Israeli intelligence got wind of that and tipped off the CIA and BKA. Security was stepped up on U.S. carriers immediately, except for Pan Am, where CIA-1's undercover surveillance was continuing. Alcazar had not realized until now that Jibril was planning an attack at or near Frankfurt. On or about December 18th, 3 days before the plane crash, Alcazar tipped off BKA through intermediaries that a bomb was to be put on a Pan Am flight. CIA-1 told Langley, and a warning was sent to various U.S. embassies, quote, but not apparently to Pan Am. The report says, quote, CIA-1 thought that BKA surveillance would pick, would pick up the action. One more time. Ominously, the report says that, quote, CIA-1 thought that BKA surveillance would pick up the action and that BKA would stop the act in case the tip was correct, unquote. Ominously, the report says that CIA-1 had now learned from Alcazar and, quote, had confirmed from its control, unquote, that McKee's team had discovered the Drugs for Hostages operation and were investigating Alcazar. Result, quote, by mid-December, the team became frustrated and angry and made plans to return to the U.S. with their photos and evidence to inform the government and to publicize their findings if the government covered up. Quote, they did not seek permission to return, which is against the rules, unquote. Although the return was, quote, unannounced, unquote, McKee and his colleagues were spotted by Alcazar's agents, quote, probably Syrian, unquote, when they made their travel plans in Beirut, suggesting their timetable was known. 2 or 3 days before the crash, a BKA agent warned his superiors of a plot to bomb a Pan Am flight, but security still wasn't tightened. And an agent of Israel's Mossad gave BKA the same tip less than 24 hours before the start of ill-fated Flight 103. A lot of alliteration there. Resuming the narrative here. Quote, BKA passed that to CIA-1 and asked for instructions. CIA-1 so reported to its control. CIA-1 did not reply to BKA, unquote. Within hours of the flight's departure, black Mercedes parked at Frankfurt Airport. It was approached by a Turkish baggage handler who took a brown Samsonite suitcase from the trunk and carried it into the employee locker area, the usual procedure with drug shipments. A BKA surveillance agent watching Pan Am's loading operation on December 21st saw the bag being placed and noted that it was different to the usual luggage being different from, it should have read here, to the usual luggage being used for smuggling. He called his office to say that, quote, something was very wrong, unquote. The report, quote, BKA passed that information to CIA-1. It reported it to its control, unquote. And here's the key part. By the way, much of this you will be hearing later in the broadcast. I'm going through this quickly by way of sort of presenting a synopsis of what you're going to hear in greater detail. If some of this is not apparently clear, we're going to stretch out and go into this at greater length later in the broadcast. A BKA surveillance agent watching Pan Am's loading operation on December 21st saw the bag being placed and noted that it was different to the usual luggage being used for smuggling. He called his office to say that something was very wrong, unquote. The report, BKA passed that information to CIA-1. It reported it to its control. Control replied, quote, don't worry about it. Don't stop it. Let it go, unquote. CIA-1 issued no instructions to BKA. BKA did nothing, unquote. The report says the bomb that brought down the Boeing 747 was made of the Czech plastic explosive Semtex and weighed about 1.25 pounds or half a kilogram. It was set with a sophisticated detonator that was controlled by barometric pressure and was designed to set and reset itself to evade a pressure technique used in security checks. Shortly after the crash, a CIA team landed a helicopter at a farm near Lockerbie, where much of the debris had landed. A suitcase was recovered, apparently with the approval of British intelligence and Scotland Yard. As for the shadowy CIA-1 group, the report leaves its status or motivation unclear in the overall context of the CIA. However, in March of 1988, BKA ran surveillance on a secret meeting in Vienna between a French government delegation led by Jean-Charles Marchiani, M-A-R-C-H-I-A-N-I, assistant to French Interior Minister Charles Pasqua, and a group of Iranians, or perhaps that's pronounced Pasqua, I don't know how, P-A-S-Q-U-A. Continuing, that information was passed to CIA-1, which noted that Al-Qassar and a British dealer then bought a quantity of arms from two British and one Polish firm, all named in the report, which were transshipped to Iran. A few days later, French hostages were held in Lebanon. The French hostages being held in Lebanon were released. And after that, the CIA-1 operation with Al-Qassar got rolling. So again, the element of U.S. intelligence, and it's worth noting here that it was an element of U.S. intelligence that is running Manzar Al-Qassar and that in turn is working very closely with BKA. BKA is the Bundeskriminalamt. That's the West German equivalent of our FBI. It's the West German Federal Police. Oh, by the way, it should be noted that BKA, the Bundeskriminalamt, was surveilling the airport, the Frankfurt airport, and in fact was heavily involved with this element of U.S. intelligence identified here as CIA-1, and that CIA-1 was relying on the BKA surveillance to a large extent. So Manzar Al-Qassar had come across the fact that the McKee team had become aware of his connection with the so-called CIA-1 group. CIA-1 reported that to its control. Control then said, let the bomb go through. We are going to go into the five pages of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report dealing with the actual executive control of the U.S. intelligence element running Manzar Al-Qassar in allowing this bomb to go through, thereby eliminating, among other things, the McKee team, which had word of the Manzar Al-Qassar U.S. connection here. Musical break, and then the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report from the horse's mouth.